Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we think about life and spirituality. Today is June 20th, 2014, and I'm very honored to have respected ACIM teacher Doug Sparks with me on the show today. Doug is one of those lucky ones who discovered the course early on, in 1976 when it was first published. He's a devoted student of the course and of Ken Wapnick. He says, through Ken's gentle tutelage, he was able to embrace the course as his journey without distance. Now, some of you may recognize that phrase, journey without distance, from the course. Doug facilitated weekly study groups for 25 years and is now a regular speaker and teacher of the course in multiple venues. I met Doug a few weeks ago at a talk he gave in Denver at the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center, and I walked away with literally pages of notes and was really impressed with his straightforward and lighthearted teaching style. One thing I loved that he said was, "The mind is the only game in town." Today, Doug is going to discuss the differences between A Course in Miracles and Biblical Christianity. Now, while you're listening, I invite you to join us in the 1-2 Radio chat room on Facebook. One of the easiest ways to get there is to go to the 1-2radio.com website, and on the left side of the page, click the chat button. You will be automatically redirected to our chat room on Facebook. Now, if you have a question or comment, please feel free to post it at the top of the page, where you will see a post that basically says, welcome to the show. And thanks to Mark Husson for his graphic skills for creating a welcome banner for this show and for each of the shows here on 1-2 Radio. So I don't know about you, but I'm ready to hear what Doug has to say. Welcome, Doug.
Well, thank you so much, CA. It's a pleasure to be on your program this morning. When I spoke with you a few weeks ago about a topic for the program, I decided that it might be a very good idea for us to talk for this hour about the differences between biblical Christianity and A Course in Miracles. And I think that because in my 30-some-odd years of working with this material now, I've found that that's a continuing source of confusion for students of the course, and as well as for people who have found biblical Christianity to be their path before they came to the course. And so what I thought we might discuss today are some of the fundamental differences between the course and the Bible. Because, in fact, the Bible and the Course in Miracles reflect entirely different and mutually exclusive theologies that can never be integrated into one coherent spirituality. And because the Course in Miracles uses the language of traditional Western mythology, which is the language of the Bible, that language often leads people to confusion about the differences between the two thought systems, and they often misunderstand and think that they're saying approximately the same thing. And this, of course, is not really true. And so I thought the burden of what we might do this morning is discuss these differences.
Doug, I would love that, because I was certainly one of those people that when I first started hearing about the course and I heard people talking about it, that was exactly my confusion. And as I had explained to our listeners a few weeks ago, it really put me off, because I thought, well, I've been there, done that. You know, I've studied the Bible, I've done the, you know, a lot of the Christian churches, I've done a lot of the Christian theologies, and I just believed that I knew what that meant. And so when I heard the same old thing again, I thought, well, this is just one more version of Christianity, and I wasn't interested. But I would also say I agree so strongly with what you're saying, because I think that's a hard thing with the course is, and in fact, I love to quote it, but I'm very careful about it, because I recognize that if you're not a course student, then I may be saying something and you don't have the faintest idea what I'm really saying, because you're interpreting those terms historically or, like, you know, from your own experience. So I think that's, in fact, that's one thing I love to do on this show, is point out those differences and make sure that people really recognize what the underlying metaphysics is. So thank you for choosing that topic, and I'm very excited about what you have to say.
Well, I thought a great place to start might be by discussing the difference in the basic thought systems of the Bible as compared to A Course in Miracles. And one of the places to start is by recognizing that one of the essential characteristics of A Course in Miracles lies in the core differences that that the Course in Miracles is a non-dualistic thought system, and the Bible is a dualistic thought system. In Christianity, and as in Judaism before it, it's a dualistic thought system in which God and the world, spirit and matter, coexist as separate states, both of which are real. Reality thus seems to be a dimension of opposites, as with good and evil, and a marked distinction from the Course's understanding of reality, which is as being only perfect unity in which there are no opposites. So when we're talking about the Bible, we're talking about a God who has permitted into existence both good and evil. And when we're talking about the Course in Miracles, we're talking about a God that is only perfect unity and without any opposite. And so that brings us to a very important beginning distinction, which is that the Course in Miracles falls into what is known in academic circles as the apophatic tradition. And this view of God, or the Godhead, emphasizes that our source is beyond all human attempts to define or classify him. So his perfectly abstract nature remains forever unknowable in this material world, beyond our powers of comprehension and expression, which are inherently limited by the physical and psychological dimensions of our specific ego selves. And so, in the Course in Miracles, only God and his creation are real, and everything else is what the Course calls illusion, or is a dream. And that makes a very, very important, essential, basic distinction between the Course and the Bible. Because in the Course, the Course teaches us that God did not create the physical universe, which includes all matter, all form, and the body. And, of course, the Bible states that God did create all of this. So that's one of the very first and most important distinctions to make between the Bible and the Course in Miracles. One is non-dualistic, that's the Course in Miracles, and the other is dualistic, which says that both good and evil coexist. In the Course in Miracles, only God and his creation are real, and everything else is a dream.
Well, and you know, that's such a great distinction because, truthfully, some of the people that I know, one of the hardest things they have, or, you know, one of their issues with the Course is they just can't move beyond that God did not create the world. That, you know, because we live in a world of dualism, and that's where we think we are, that world of contrast, black and white, good and bad, up and down. Everything on planet Earth that's our experience is about contrast. And so this psychologically and or intellectually is a hard, hard thing to grasp.
Yes, I fully agree with you, and every student of the Course wrestles with this, certainly at the beginning. I thought I might read a section out of the Course where it talks about how the world arose in terms of the Course's metaphysics. This is out of the text in the Course in Miracles, and I'll just read a little bit here, and then we'll stop and talk about this. Most Course students are familiar with this line. Into eternity, where all is one, there crept a tiny man idea at which the Son of God remembered not to laugh. Eternity is a synonym for heaven. So into heaven, where all was one, there crept a tiny mad idea at which the Son of God remembered not to laugh, which is just a poetic way of saying that we forgot to recognize that it was a silly idea that we could be separate from our Creator. And the Course's explanation of how this could not have happened is very simple. It's just saying that if it's not God's will, it cannot happen. And the Course's position is that it's not God's will that his creation ever be separate from him or abide in any state that is not perfect. And so what this sentence is saying is that the Son of God entertained this tiny mad idea, which would have been some form of the idea of, I wonder what it would be like to be separate from the oneness in heaven and to be autonomous and to be on my own and to be able to will separately for myself than God wills for me. And so when we took that idea seriously, it seemed to have serious and real effects for us, which is what we all experience as reality or the world. And so the world then arose from our taking this impossible, tiny, mad idea seriously that we could be separate from God. And that's the origin of the dream. And so the Course goes on to say that after making this mistake of thinking that this was actually possible for us to be separate, the only way that we could experience that was to seem to put ourselves to sleep and to dream that we were separate, because in reality it would be impossible to be separate from God, because that's not His will. And so when we took that idea seriously, what we did was we made a very serious world for ourselves, and because we seemed to put ourselves to sleep, we didn't know that we were dreaming. And so what the Course says is that together we can laugh both of these silly ideas away, the idea that it's a serious idea and that it's possible of both accomplishment and real effects. Together we can laugh them both away and understand that time cannot intrude upon eternity. It is a joke to think that time can come to circumvent eternity, which means there is no time. So that first basic idea is crucial to the understanding of the difference between the Bible and the Course in Miracles, which is that in the Bible, of course, God created the world out of nothing. And in the Course in Miracles, it's saying that the separation never really happened. It only seemed to happen, but in fact never really happened at all. So I would like to read you just another little blurb out of the Course itself that discusses this. It says, time lasted but an instant in your mind with no effect upon eternity. And so, as all time passed and everything exactly as it was before the way to nothingness was made, the tiny instant you would keep and make eternal passed away in heaven too soon for anything to notice it had come. What disappeared too quickly to affect the simple knowledge of the Son of God could hardly still be there for you to choose to be your teacher. Only in the past, an ancient past, too short to make a world in answer to creation, did this world appear to rise. So very long ago, for such a tiny interval of time that not one note in heaven's song was missed. Yet in each unforgiving act or thought, in every judgment, and in all belief in sin, is that one instant still called back as if it could be made again in time. You keep an ancient memory before your eyes, and he who lives in memories alone is unaware of where he is. So where we really are is in heaven with God, dreaming of exile. So we've never really left the perfect safety of God's creation, but we're dreaming that we have.
That's a heck of a deal.
Yeah. Not a very good deal either, although
no.
It's very difficult for the Course to convince us that it's not a good deal.
Well, yeah.
we like the idea of being separate. We like the idea of being on our own, and we're very attracted to the specialness that all of us try to create for ourselves. You know, I'm me with my own personal history, and I think that's very, very important. And I'm quite reticent about giving that up as my identity.
You know, yeah, and even when I think I am, I mean, I kid myself into thinking that I am. You know, I'll read the Course, I'll practice some of the workbook lessons, and I'm like, you know, yeah, this life, it just kind of sucks sometimes. And, you know, I'm ready to give it up, but I'm not. You know, and it's interesting how I just kid myself a lot about that.
Oh yes, and everyone does. We're not too anxious to actually give up our attachment to our specialists. In fact, we're quite resistant to it. And so, one of the things that all of us, as students of the Course, need to learn to be clear with ourselves about is that we're very resistant to what this Course is teaching us. And all we need to do about that is just be honest with ourselves about that. We are resistant to that. We don't have to fight with ourselves about that. We just have to notice that we are resistant.
Good point.
So We'll leave that point behind and go on to the second major distinction between the Course in Miracles and biblical Christianity. And this, too, is about God. And it's the idea that the God of the Course in Miracles does not even know about the sin of separation, since to know about it would make it real. And so he doesn't know about it, let alone react to it. The God of the Bible perceives sin directly, as is portrayed in the Garden of Eden story discussed. And, of course, discusses how God is offended by Adam and Eve disobeying his commandments, and he becomes upset about that, angry about that, and, of course, throws them out of the Garden of Eden and puts angels with burning spears to guard the entrance so that they can never return. So his responses are vigorous, dramatic, and at times punitive, to say the very least. The God of the Course in Miracles, on the other hand, doesn't know anything about this because it never really happened in fact. It only seemed to happen. Seemed is one of those words in the Course in Miracles, S-E-E-M-E-D or S-E-E-M, seem, that you want to take note of whenever you read it, because what the Course is saying is that what seemed to happen never really happened at all. So when you see that word seemed, it's saying the opposite of what seemed to happen.
Thanks for pointing that out, Doug.
What that then means about sin is that sin never really happened because separation never really happened, and so nothing really happened. And so there's nothing to atone for in the traditional sense of the word atonement as it's used in the Bible. We don't have to make nice to God because he's not offended, because nothing really happened. We're only dreaming that something happened. And so all that's happened is that we made a mistake, and so we haven't sinned, and so we don't need to be punished. We simply need to have our mistake corrected. And that's the burden that the Course takes on for itself, is to help us correct that mistake. So God's not angry at us, and we don't have to be fearful of him, which helps us escape from that very difficult psychological position that students of the Bible find themselves in, because, of course, God's mad at them for their sin or is in some way upset about it. And so they have to try and atone for that, which means to show their contriteness and show that they're sorry that they sinned. And of course, the whole story of the crucifixion of Jesus is about that, and we'll probably talk about that more in just a minute.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I love, you know, I think all of this stuff is very hard to grasp because we're so steeped, or at least I'm so steeped in Christianity, or so steeped in the biblical teachings. And that's why one reason I love the analogy of the dream, because I get what it means to fall asleep and have a dream that seems so incredibly real. In fact, last night I dreamt that the spider that was at least a foot, you know, across kept chasing me. Now, I'm sure there's all kinds of meanings in that, but the point is it seemed very, very real, and I was very scared during the dream. But when I woke up and slowly could start processing it, I realized it was an illusion, and yet I recognized how real it seemed. And so to me, that's one of the best analogies for understanding how this could even be true. You know, because like I said, I think it's really hard to intellectually grasp these kind of concepts, that there is only God and nothing else, that God did not make the world. But it does make sense to me that somehow we did fall asleep, and that we're dreaming this, and that's why we have to come to some kind of awakening and consciousness in the dream in order to let it go. So I'm glad we have that analogy to kind of, you know, bring it right back to something that we can understand.
Yes, there's a section in chapter 18 of the Course, the second section, which is titled The Basis of the Dream. And in that section it says, you know, your nighttime dreams show you that your mind has the power to make up an entire world and make it seem real while you're asleep. And it's worth noting that in our nighttime dreams, we make up a world of both time and space that don't actually exist. But that time and that space seems completely real to us while we're dreaming. And in that dream, in our nighttime dreams, it seems to us that it's the figures in the dream that we are dreaming that cause us to have a reaction and to causes us to have the experience that we're having. And it's only when we wake up that we realize that we were giving ourselves that experience, that there was no one there doing anything. There was no time, there was no place, there was no space, and there was no one there doing anything. It was only our mind making up images, projecting them onto the screen of our mind, where we mistook them for reality. And then that section in the basis of the dream in chapter 18 goes on to say that all of our time is spent in dreaming, that our nighttime dreams and our daytime dreams have a different form, and that's the only difference between them. And by the difference in form, it simply means that while you're dreaming at night, for example, in our waking world, there are no spiders that are a foot large that I know of. But in your dream, you see a spider, and it seems completely real to you while you sleep. And your mind doesn't go, oh, wait a minute, that can't be real because there's no such thing as a spider that's a foot tall. And so what Jesus is pointing out to us in that section is that we don't realize that reality is violated by our dreams. We just accept it because it's a part of our dream as if it were real.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's amazing. I mean, you know, even think in life, some of the times that we'll accept something as true, and then later when we find out it's not, we kind of look at it and said, how could we have ever believed that was true?
Yes.
And, you know, and we think we're silly, and it's like, how could we have ever believed that? But boy, you know, it goes back to the Course often says that we give credibility to whatever we think. We find the evidence for it, and we give it credibility because we made it. And what, to me, that philosophically, that is such an important concept, that we give credibility to what we make. If we make it, we believe that it's true, but we forget we made it.
Right. In psychology, there's a term for that. It's called vested interest. We have a vested interest in seeing our dreams as true. And so we do. And we do that just as a function of our wish to do so. You know, Sigmund Freud, 100 years ago, pointed out that dreams were wish fulfillment. It seemed to us in dreams that we could make the world as we would have it be. And so that's just exactly what we do. And that's what we're doing in what the Course calls our waking dream as well, what we call reality, is that we're just dreaming, but it seems to us that it's the figures in the dream that are causing us. There's a very interesting telling, a couple of sentences in the beginning of this, a section in chapter 27, of course, The Dreamer of the Dream, where it says, like to a dream of punishment in which the dreamer is unconscious of what brought on the attack against himself, he sees himself attacked unjustly and by something not himself. He is the victim of this, quote, something else, unquote, a thing outside himself for which he has no reason to be held responsible. And so that's another psychological element of the Course that shows us that we like feeling like we're victims, because that means that I don't have to be responsible for my reaction. I'm perfectly justified in being upset because I've been unjustly attacked. But if I really take into consideration what the Course is teaching us, which is that this is my dream, and by that I don't mean Doug's dream, I mean the mind's dream. And the mind in the Course in Miracles is not a human mind. It's the mind that is outside of time and space, dreaming time and space. And so when the Course says all of our time is spent in dreaming, it means that all of our time is really referencing this mind that is outside time and space, dreaming time and space. But because I don't realize I'm dreaming, I actually think there are figures out there in the world that are causing me to have all of these adverse reactions to the world, when in fact, it's really only my dream.
And that's just so hard to believe. You know, because especially, you know, I think it's easier to believe when things are going really well for ourselves. But, you know, when things aren't going well, you know, I can't help but say, well, why would I create this? I mean, why would I do this? And I want it to make sense. And that's one thing studying the Course has done, though, is I recognize it doesn't make sense because, as the Course says, we're insane.
Yes. Yes, and of course, sanity does not make sense to the insane. You cannot convince a delusional person that they're having delusions. It's simply impossible. The beauty of entertaining this idea and working with it is that our whole escape from the dream lies in beginning to recognize this, because all that we need to do is recognize the problem the way it is instead of the way that we've set it up. And the way I've set it up is that you're causing me to have an experience. But the way that it really is that I'm choosing how to react to you, and so I'm really giving myself this experience. And you can work with that, we can all work with that at a very practical level. I can keep reminding myself that I'm doing this to myself. And I always encourage students of the Course to practice with the little things. You know, get in your car and drive around town and just watch how you react to the other drivers. And remind yourself that you're choosing those reactions. You know, if I'd gotten in the car with you for your drive to wherever you might be going this morning, and I said, listen, every time somebody in traffic does something offensive to you, I'm going to give you $100 cash right on the spot. So instead of being upset by the other drivers when they honk their horns and cut you off in traffic and make gestures at you that are not polite and maybe spring things out the window at you, I'm going to be handing you $100. So you're probably not going to be upset by the things in traffic. You're going to be delighted by them, which is just a silly little simple explanation that illustrates that we're really choosing how we react, to the external world. So if I'm giving you $100 every time you're offended, you wouldn't be offended. You'd be delighted.
That's right. I'm going to have to take you with me the next time I run errands, Doug.
You may have to lend me a few $100 before we do
okay.
That.
Yeah, but what a great explanation.
Maybe we can find some unsuspecting soul that will do that, that will lend us the money.
Yeah, but see, what a great explanation that, you know, our interpretation of it is I'm making money off of this, or our interpretation then becomes I'm benefiting from this. So once again, right. If we saw everything that happened to us as part of a curriculum that could wake us up, that could get us closer to where we need to be, then you're right. It wouldn't be offensive to us.
Exactly. And so when I say practice with the little things, I mean practice with the things that are not so overwhelming to you that you can't allow yourself the psychological space to change the way that you're looking. And by allow yourself the psychological space, I mean that you're not so overcome with fear that you react in just a knee-jerk kind of way in which you just become fearful and then react by judging and attacking. So in these situations that are not so overwhelming for us, it's a perfect place to practice. You know, when somebody says, you know, I'll call you tomorrow, and then they forget to call you, that's a great thing to practice with, to realize that you choose whether to be offended by that and to take it personally, or whether to recognize that it's not a personal thing at all, and that this person doesn't need to be judged against by you. Mm-hmm. As we practice these things, though, what we begin to realize is that we don't really want to give up seeing ourselves unfairly treated because we like that. And the reason that we like being unfairly treated is because it then means that I'm not responsible for my reaction. And, of course, the Course is telling me just the opposite, that I'm always responsible for my reactions, irregardless of what others might do or say or not do or say. So practicing with the things that are not so overwhelming with us is a very important practice for all of the students of the Course.
Yes.
When you bring up this kind of idea to people, a lot of times you will notice that people immediately jump to some very extreme thing. And so they'll say, well, yeah, that might be true in traffic, but what if somebody, you know, kidnaps my loved one or harms me or hurts me in some physical way? What about that? And, of course, what that is, what the reason that people react in that way is because they're very reticent to give up this idea especially in its more extreme forms. And so our minds jump to those extreme forms as a defense. But it's still true that with practice, you can work your way up the ladder and can get yourself to the point where you can change your mind about all things. But that takes a lot of practice and a lot of work. An analogy I like to use is that the first time that you go to a swimming pool, if you're not familiar with swimming pools and being in water and swimming, all of that is very fearful for you. And so you don't just go up on a 10-meter platform and dive off. It's far too frightening. So when people bring up these extreme examples of things that happen to us in the world, that's why suggesting to someone that they go to the swimming pool and go straight up onto the 10-meter board. And that's not what you want to do. You want to sit down on the side of the pool, dip your feet in there, get used to what the water feels like, ease yourself into the shallow end of the pool, get used to what it's like to be in the water, and then maybe jump off of the side of the pool first, or sit down and ease yourself off the side of the pool, then jump off the side of the pool, and then eventually as you get used to the water and you learn how to swim, you dive off the side of the pool, and then you get on the little 1 meter or 3 meter board and jump off of that first and then dive off of it, and then you work your way up to the higher and higher diving boards that you might want to jump or dive off of. And so what was fearful at first later becomes fun. You if you get used to that sort of thing and learn to enjoy it, jumping off of a very high height into water can be a real thrill and a lot of fun. Whereas if you try to do that right at first, it would be terrifying. So the same is true in learning to practice this course. You just can't start with the great big things that are very up, very high up our hierarchy of illusions, the things that really, really frighten us, like harm to our bodies or death or losing all of our money or any of those kinds of things. You want to practice with the smaller things. So drive around town in your car and watch yourself react. And again, the idea is not to force yourself to react in a forgiving way, but to watch how you don't want to do that and to learn that what you're doing is learning to be more gentle with yourself as you learn to look at these things and take responsibility for your reactions. So the whole idea is to practice with the things that you're willing to practice with, and when you're too frightened to practice, just admit that to yourself. Say, I'm too afraid of love right now to try and apply it to this situation, so I'm just staying where I am. But that's an honest statement. I'm deciding to stay where I am and not change my mind. There's no rule that says you have to change your mind. The only motivation to change your mind is that it will make life a lot more peaceful for you. And so the course is trying to sell us on the motivation that we're doing all of this for ourselves. It's not to be a good Course in Miracles student. It's not to be a great person in the world. It's not to be this big, magnanimous, spiritual person. You want to practice in order to give yourself a more peaceful experience of the world. Because what we offer to others is what we experience for ourselves. So if I learn to think of others kindly and inclusively, I experience kindness and inclusiveness. If I go on thinking of others as separate from me with separate interests, then I experience separation and competition. So I want to learn that I'm giving myself my experiences all the time. They're not coming from outside of me, as I've been telling myself mistakenly all along.
Yeah, and you know, what I was just thinking, what's so difficult for me is saying that's it, I'm giving myself these experiences, but can I let go of the outcome? Like, for instance, just what you said, the experience itself may not change. You know, people may still cut you off in traffic, but it's what you feel about it that changes. And, you know, I think, but I still want to get in there and I want the situation to change.
That is such an important point, and it's what all students of the Course in Miracles run into. We begin to understand the ideas that the Course is teaching us, but we still are so attached to blame because we've listened to the ego story for so long that either I'm guilty or somebody else is guilty. And since I don't want to be guilty myself, I've mis- taught myself that the way that I get rid of my guilt is by putting it on somebody else. And so that's why we're all so psychologically tempted to carry on with this unfortunate habit of blaming others all of the time, because it then gives me the impression that I'm not so guilty. So I'm always on the make to find people that I can point an accusing finger at and say, you're the guilty one, and at least you're more guilty than I am. And so I'm off the hook because you're guilty.
Right.
And of course, that doesn't really work, because when I accuse you of being the guilty one, what I'm unconsciously doing is reinforcing my own guilt, because somewhere in my own mind, I really do know that it's not you that's causing me to have this experience. And so I feel guilty at the unconscious level for accusing you of what you did not do to me, because you didn't cause me to have this experience. I caused me to have this experience. And so I'm blaming you without it really being your fault. And that's true, irregardless of how you may have acted. I'll read another line in the course that talks about it.
Okay.
So the secret of salvation is this, and by salvation, of course, means being saved from all of the torment of living in this world and feeling unfairly treated. The secret of salvation is but this, that you are doing this unto yourself. No matter what the form of attack, this still is true. Whoever takes the role of enemy and of attacker, still is this the truth. Whatever seems to be the cause of any pain and suffering you feel, this is still true. For you would not react at all to figures in a dream you knew that you were dreaming. Let them be as hateful and as vicious as they may, they could have no effect on you unless you fail to recognize it is your dream.
Now, where is that in the text? Would you tell us?
Yes, that's in chapter 27. It's the section 8. It's titled "The Hero of the Dream."
Oh,
and,
yeah. Okay.
It's on page 587, paragraph 10. Is where that starts. It's right at the very end of that section.
Okay, so chapter 27, "Hero of the Dream." Okay, because I wanted to go back and read that again. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's paragraph 10. It starts out, "The secret of salvation is but this." So, coming back to our discussion again about the differences between the Bible and the Course in Miracles, I think those first two points that we were making are both about God. That God did not create the world, and God does not see sin as real in the Course in Miracles. And those are juxtaposed with the Bible's believing that God did create the world and teaching that, and that God is both sees the sin of our separation and is reacting to it in the world. So those are two very fundamental distinctions that are irreconcilable differences between the Course and the Bible. So the next two distinctions that I would like to talk about are about Jesus. It's very important for students of both the Bible and the Course in Miracles to understand that the presentation of God in the Bible is very different than the presentation of God in the Course in Miracles. And the person of Jesus in the Course in Miracles is very different from the person of Jesus as presented in the Bible. And so they're rather different characters indeed. And so in the Course in Miracles, Jesus is equal to everyone else. He's a part of God's one Son, or Christ. The Bible's Jesus is seen as special, apart, and therefore ontologically different from everyone else. Ontologically simply means in terms of how he came into being. So he's ontologically different from everyone else in the Bible. In the Course in Miracles, he is the same as everyone else. So in the Bible, the ontologically different Jesus is different from everyone else, being God's only begotten Son, the second person of the Trinity. And, of course, as St. Paul said, all of the rest of us are just adopted children. So we're not on the same plane with Jesus, which, of course, psychologically presents a bit of a problem, because it's a little bit difficult for us to really, truly love someone who has something that we don't have. And, of course, that's the position that we're in with the Jesus of the Bible. as juxtaposed with the Jesus of the Course in Miracles, who presents himself simply as our older brother who has already learned something that we are yet to learn, but our potential for learning that is exactly the same as his. So Jesus says to us in the Course in Miracles, I was a man who remembered spirit and its knowledge. As a man, I did not attempt to counteract error with knowledge, but to correct error from the bottom up. So what he means by that is that he's going to explain to us the basic differences between truth and illusions, but he's going to meet us here in the illusion where we believe that we are, and he's going to teach us here at this level how to use the dream that we have made for the purpose of waking up rather than for the purpose of keeping ourselves asleep. And so all he does is ask us to reinterpret the world we see, not to deny that it seems completely real to us, as we've been discussing for the first half hour of this program, that it's virtually impossible for us to deny the reality of the body in the world and to deny the reality, in quotes, of the world for ourselves. And so the Course doesn't ask us to do that. It explains to us that the truth is that the world is an illusion, but it meets us right where we are, where we believe that the illusion is not an illusion, that it's real. And so it tells us that to try and deny the reality of the body is a particularly unworthy form of denial. It doesn't ask us to deny that our body and the world seem real to us. And instead, what Jesus does is he meets us in the dream and shows us how to use the dream to awaken instead of to stay asleep. And, of course, the way that we do this is to practice what the Course calls forgiveness. And forgiveness in the Course in Miracles, like all the terms in the Course in Miracles, is defined differently than it is in the Bible. In the Course in Miracles, forgiveness is nothing more than a change of mind. It's changing from the wrong-minded way or the egocentric way of looking at the world to what the Course calls the right-minded way or the non-egocentric way of looking at the world, where we choose inclusion rather than exclusion. We choose to see another's interest as the same as our own rather than seeing ourselves as in competition with everything else, which would be the wrong-minded way of looking. And so again, the Jesus of the Course in Miracles is not ontologically different than us at all. He has simply recognized that the world is a dream and has awakened from us, and now he's going to teach us how to do that too if we so choose. He's not forcing that on us. He's not telling us we have to do that, but he is telling us that we would certainly be a whole lot happier and a whole lot more peaceful if we would do that. And in fact, we would free ourselves from the prison house of the world entirely if we would follow his teachings.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing, I wish I had this direct quote, Doug, but I don't. So maybe if you know where it is, you can say, you know, I always think that the tone of the Course in Miracles is rather humorous. And part of the reason I think it's humorous is because he just says it like it is and then just lets it go, you know, with no defense. And there's a place where he says, you know, something equivalent to what you just said. I am like you. I'm your older brother. And the only difference between us now is that, you know, and like I said, I'm kind of butchering this, but it's sort of like he said, I know that I'm God's son. And that's it. That's all I've got. And, you know, and so what it gets to me is how often in our life, it's all the clutter. It's all the other stuff that we keep adding on. And so very much this is, of course, in undoing, letting all that stuff go. So as Jesus says, that's it. That's all I've got. You know, I'm God's son. I'm here. I don't need any of the rest of these trappings. That's it. That's the difference between us. And I love it because I think we always look, as spiritual seekers, we're always looking to add something to our lives, to add knowledge, to add wisdom, without ever recognizing that it's the stuff we have to take away. It's the stuff we need to undo that's going to leave us back in our divine form. And have literally nothing else, like Jesus says.
There are a number of very important points that you just brought up there. Certainly the first of which is that the Course is filled with humor. Jesus coach gentle fun at us all the way through. But he's not being derisive towards us at all. He's just showing us that we can be amused by our dilemma rather than dismayed about it. And so he has a lot of fun with us. And the course is filled with all kinds of puns and all kinds of humor. If you can begin to recognize that it's there, and of course, as you work with this material, it becomes more and more evident as we become less and less defensive that there's nothing serious going on here. The only problem that we have is that we forgot to laugh. We're taking this all very seriously. Of course, says to us that it's very hard for us to realize that the world is not a serious place because it seems to have all of these serious consequences that are the effect of our taking the world so seriously. But if we would learn to lighten up about it a little bit and not take ourselves and the world so seriously, then we could have a much more lighthearted approach to the world. I think maybe the quote that you might be thinking of, and I'm not sure if this is it or not, but Jesus says very succinctly at one place in the Course that I saw the face of Christ in all of my brothers and remembered God. And what he means by that is that the face of Christ is simply a symbol in the Course in Miracles for seeing our brothers and sisters as innocent. We don't deny that they're behaving badly, but in many instances, but we recognize that when people are behaving badly, it's because they're afraid. It's not because they're evil. And so the more badly they're acting, the more afraid they must be, which means that our response to them should be a loving response, not a condemning response. We don't want to attack somebody who's already frightened. We want to be gentle with somebody who's already frightened. That doesn't mean that behavior at the level of the world doesn't need to be corrected, and that sometimes that requires doing extreme things like arresting somebody and putting them in prison if they are not well enough socialized to not be a threat to themselves and others in society. But you want to do that with an attitude of not punishment, but simple correction. Where you see that this brother who's acting badly is just like me. I mean, I can remember all of them. I can't remember all of them, but I can remember many, many of the times that I myself have acted badly. So who am I to judge somebody else when they're the one acting badly? We kind of take turns with that in this passion play that we are carrying on here in the world. So the idea is to simply recognize that people are innocent underneath their bad behavior. They're simply frightened right now. They're like little children. When a little child gets scared, you don't scream at the child to stop crying. You pick them up and hold them in your arms and rock them and reassure them that everything is all right. Well, as adults, we want to learn to do that with each other also, not in that simple childish way, but in an adult way where we say to people, your behavior is not okay, but I'm not condemning you for this. I see you as just the same as myself. You're simply making a mistake right now that I've made myself many, many times. And so I want to model for others that there's another way of reacting to people's bad behavior. And, of course, again, it becomes imperative for us to practice with the littler things so that the bigger things don't overwhelm us. And so learning to be kind and gentle with people in traffic, to make it our good pleasure to allow people to get in front of us, to try to drive in a helpful way with everyone out there instead of a competitive way, is a great place to practice because that's the way that we want to learn to live our lives in the world.
Yes, and you know, and yet, what you're saying, that's one of the hardest things for many of us. We can be gentle and kind in a lot of situations, but not when we're driving. It kind of brings out the worst in me, Doug.
Yeah, I heard a joke the other day. Is it true that we never really learn to swear until we learn to drive?
Yeah. I could believe that's true because, yeah, there again, yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, but maybe it's impersonal too. When I'm with somebody, like if I'm standing in a line at a grocery store, you know, you're not, it's harder to be unkind to somebody right up front and personal in your space. Whereas to this nameless driver, this faceless driver, it's easy to somehow just lose your cool.
Right. But that's why I always suggest practicing in traffic. It's the perfect classroom.
Okay, well, we will do that this week. And I'm looking at the clock and I'm recognizing, believe it or not, we only have 5 minutes left in the show. So one thing I would like to ask you is, do you have any upcoming workshops, any talks? I know you do a lot in the Boulder area and in the Denver metro area, but is there anything that you would like to announce to our listeners that they might be interested in participating in?
Sure. I do workshops once a month. I'm currently doing them in Longmont, Colorado, at a friend's house there that has a nice big room where we can all sit comfortably and have a day-long workshop. The next workshop I'm doing is on July the 12th, and the title of it is The Strain of Constant Judgment. One of the articles that says the strain of constant judgment is virtually intolerable. So I want to talk about how we're harming ourselves with our judgment and how to undo that dilemma for ourselves. And so that workshop will be on July the 12th. And if you're interested in information about that, you can contact me at my email, which is D, like Delta, Sparks, like Sparks from a fire, D Sparks at Indra, which is INDRA, India November Delta Romeo Alpha at Indra.com. So it's dsparks@indra.com. You can just contact me there, and I'll be glad to send you information about that workshop. I'll be doing another workshop at the Miracle Center, you know, Rocky Mountain Miracle Center down in Denver on September the 14th. I haven't picked a topic for that workshop yet, but again, if you want to be on my mailing list, you can just contact me at that email address, and I'll be glad to get that information to you.
Okay. And everybody, if you didn't get that email address, you can always contact me at ca@cabrooks.com, and I'll make sure that you get Doug's information or at least get his email so you can get on that mailing list.
Thank you, CA. And another thing I'd like to do just very quickly is put in a plug for the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. That's the foundation that has sponsored the publication of the course, and that their website, which you can reach simply by googling FACIM, Foundation for A Course in Miracles, is a motherload of information about the course. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in this material to check out that website, because everything is there, and it's a great place to use as a resource for material about the course.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the people who listen to this show regularly know that's where I get all my materials, the recordings I have of Ken that we play on the show almost every week, that's where I get them. Their online bookstore is just unbelievable in terms of the number of workshops and talks and lectures and recordings that they have of Ken and a few other people as well. So it's a wonderful resource. And the other thing I like about that online bookstore too is sometimes you can get the things on CD, but if you're kind of like me and you're impatient, many of them are instant downloads. And so you can just get it on your computer right that, you know, practically right that minute. So those are wonderful resources, and you can just go through that and see the different topics that you may want to listen to. It's a great way of studying the course.
Yes, absolutely. You can also download the glossary index for the course, which will show you the difference in the way the course uses language as opposed to the way the Bible uses language. Not opposed to, but in contrast to.
Yay. Okay, well, Doug, we've got to wrap up, but I want to thank you so much. I hope you will come back and we'll talk about something else. I really appreciate, you know, how you succinctly really gave us some things that were differences between biblical Christianity and the course today, some things to really encourage us. And I want to say thanks to the listeners and to everybody in the chat room who are making comments and participating that way. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver, today. And you can find me for readings, personal consultations, mentoring and coaching on 12listen.com. So please feel free to request a scheduled reading on a day and time that's good for you. And today, we are saying goodbye to the Gemini twins with a special sale, with the summer solstices tomorrow when the sun moves into Cancer. So you've got about 5 minutes to get yourself another cup of coffee or tea or a snack or lunch or dinner, depending on where you are, and then be right back for the Through Line with Christine DeMaurier coming up next on Fabulous Fridays on 1-2 Radio. Until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.